Morning. I first want to start this by saying that the words you hear and the thoughts you hear from the speaker are not necessarily those of the C3 or its affiliates. Because I'm not going to be dealing in lofty things as much as I'm going to push it down to more concrete things. My background is not with Rilke or with Nietzsche or with Mary Oliver. My background is more like Neil deGrasse Tyson and Carl Sagan and Charles Darwin. So I will be down in the weeds and therefore taking opinions, making belief statements as opposed to factual statements, because really when you get to death, there's not a lot we can say about what happens after death, is there? So there's no evidence either way. So I'll leave it right there. Now the reason I picked this topic is, number one, it's a great question, I would think. And it's a question we seem to avoid making most of our lives. And so I thought, well, as long as we're talking about the great questions and as long as there is a hole in the calendar, I would try to fill that. Because I'm motivated by my own needs, and I'll just say that I'm 76. So does that tell you why I care? I didn't care when I was 13, I know that. And what I want to do is start making categories and leaving some categories behind, because just so you know where I'm going. You can say that on a timeline, as you live your life, and let's say death becomes more interesting to you, there is what I'll call angst, which is driven by I can't use my hands. given our I think a biological need to survive, the fact that we know we're going to die brings angst. Now, you may have worked through this and you may feel good about everything. I haven't quite reached that point. So there's angst. Now, after death, there's grief, but not from the person who had the angst. The grief is somewhere else, with everyone else. So I'm going to take the grief part, and I'm going to put that aside and say I'm going to be dealing with the angst part. And so I want to start talking about what is death and what does it mean to be dead. And first of all, I want to point out that it's universal. All living things will die. And that's kind of a big statement, and it's something everybody knows, but I just wanted to say that is a characteristic of death. Everybody and everything that's alive will die. But I also want to say that there are analogies with everything else in the world as well. You could say that a film, the old-fashioned kind where they put it on cellulose and put it on a reel, that had a lifetime. And eventually, that film will turn crusty and yellow and start to fall into dust. You could call that death, I think, pretty easily. An old car, you junk it, they grind it up, they melt it down into an ingot. Is that car still there? No. Is the car dead? Well, you could say that, couldn't you? I mean, you can go through a number of things. Cities have died and disappeared. And they discover them under 5 feet of dirt somewhere. In other words, everybody who lived there and the city itself was forgotten. Wouldn't you call that city dead, in a way? So I'm going to expand that to the universe. All suns will die. All planets will die. Everything will eventually be cold and, I'll say, drifting. I don't really know. But the point is that everything dies except for the Roadrunner. If you've ever seen dynamite go off in your hand, if you've ever seen an anvil coming down off a cliff and land on you, All these things, it doesn't seem to matter to the Roadrunner, so we can say he's the only immortal entity that I know about. Not only is it universal, it's irreversible. Once you die, there's no going back. And those people who have near-death experiences, they just weren't dead. So nobody comes back. And the last thing is that it's fully anticipated by us. We know we're going to die. So those three elements are part of the death sort of view that I'm taking. And so I would entitle this section of the talk, From Nothing to Nothing. And so if we can envision the fact that the universe is full of stuff, matter, let's call it, and that we don't exist yet at that period of time, and then there's a birth. Well, where did that person come from? Well, basically, it came from, or this person came from, the elements that are part of the earth. And then there was life, and then there's death, and then what happens after that? The elements return to the earth. So it's from nothing and to nothing. And what I'd like to do now is read something I'd heard just this week from Neil deGrasse Tyson, who, if you listen to him, he can really wax eloquent all on his own without reading anything. I have to read it. And this is what he said. He was talking about the same thing in a different way. You can take one of the greatest of all cosmic perspectives that exists, and it is the revelation that emerged mid-20th century that the atoms of our body are traceable to the crucibles in the centers of stars, and then later exploded, spreading that enrichment into pristine gas clouds that then formed star systems with planets, one of which was the Sun with Earth. So that we are not simply in this universe alive, yes, the universe is alive within us. That is the gift of modern astrophysics to civilization that borders on the spiritual. So that when you stand out in the night sky and look up, do you say, we're small and the universe is so big? You might say that, and it would be true. But a bigger fact is that you are made of the same ingredients as those stars. You're not just poetically, we're talking literally, stardust that achieves consciousness to contemplate the extent of the universe in which we live. And so, the greater is that moving horizon, the more of this we find we are a participant of the great unfolding of cosmic events. Now, he just said that. I don't know. The point is that we are part of stars, we are part of the earth, and we, in a sense, what makes us special is not the fact that we are these elements, but the elements are arranged in such a way to create larger pieces that are now interacting with other pieces, and we have life, all from the ingredients that came out of the earth. Now, how does this happen? Well, I think we all know that from nothing, a woman has a few-minute engagements with a man, and then something starts, right? And this woman, this mother, is going to be creating one of the most complex entities in the universe, as far as we know. And how does she do this? Well, she sorts socks, she buys shoes, she walks the dog, she goes to work, she watches TV, sleeps, does all those things. And sort of as a side thing, she makes this baby. And what materials is she using? Well, bananas, yogurt, French fries, beans, eggs, milk, you name it. That's the ingredients. So it's kind of a wondrous, magnificent thing. It reminds me of Back to the Future, that movie about Well, you probably remember it. At the very end of it, the Dr. Brown, I think it was, Dr. Brown returns. He's the guy with the white hair, and he's driving a DeLorean. And he comes to pick up, Michael Fox, he says, "We got to rush back. Your children are in trouble." That means the woman standing next to him, they must have gotten married. And he says, "But I need to fill up." And he went to a trash can. And he pulled out some eggshells and a can of beer and a few other things and dumped them into what was labeled a fusion reactor. He lifts the lid, he dumps all the stuff in. Well, that's a lot like what I just described, isn't it? It's sort of like we're making things out of other things, and you wouldn't imagine that we can make something so complex out of this stuff from the earth. So I just want to mention that I want to keep going back to this idea that we're elemental, not just these great entities that are magnificent in their structures, but elemental. We are, if we were to take our bodies and break it down, and I started lining up the components, I would have 13 of a 165-pound person. I'd have 13 milk jugs all filled with water, gallons of water. That's how much water we have of us. Then I'd have 2.5 gallons of carbon. I'd have 3/4 of carbon, a gallon of nitrogen. Then I'd have 3 cups of calcium. And I'd have 2 cups of phosphorus, and then I have a bunch of little vials of a bunch of little stuff like iodine and iron and all those other things. So we're mostly water, and we have all these other things too. That's pretty amazing that this can come together and make consciousness, right? That we think, we feel emotions, we sense the world, we have memories. All of this is coming out of this elementary or elemental material. And this is sort of like the theme I have, which is this is coming out of our brain. Now, how do I know it's brain oriented? Well, because we've had enough injuries of brains to know that when certain areas are injured, certain things happen to the person's life. They lose their memory, or they lose their ability to move, or what have you. We also know that if we inject, or if they take a pill with a certain chemical in it, they will feel euphoria, they'll feel all these other things. And we can watch it on the fMRI, and which shows this lighting up area of the brain. And so we can basically say that all this stuff is coming out of our brain, which are complicated things made up of these elements that I've been talking about. So, who are we? What is it that dies when we die? Well, I'll ask you to think about it in a hypothetical. Let's say you were captured by an evil person, and that they had you chained down so you can't move, and he said, "I'm going to be cutting parts of you off, and it's going to be, and you get to choose which one it is." So, what would you choose first, right? All right. I'm not going to ask you, actually. I'm just going to say, my guess is the last thing you want, assuming that they had equipment that you can hook up along the way and keep the body running. The last thing you want to lose is what? Your head. Because in that head is the brain. That's where all your memories are. That's where all your self is. So that's sort of an important point from my point of view, is that we are what we have up here. We are that. So, moving along from there, I would entitle this one, "Evolution Ruined a Perfectly Good Story." And that is, I was convinced, and many people were convinced for centuries, that if you saw a watch, you'd realize it needed a watch designer, a watchmaker. And then Darwin comes along, and he tells us a story that's much different. He says that we are made from millions of errors in copying the DNA. So it's kind of like the scriptorium where the monks were copying one script after another, and they forgot a comma, and it went on. And if it still read well, I mean, there's a typo in the front cover of the bulletin there that says how instead of now. So if you read that, typos happen. And this is what happened with the mutation of a person's DNA. And so what we have here is evolution coming through and saying, no, there wasn't a designer. There was a series of mistakes, millions of them. And the environment chose which one we're going to be carried on to the next generation or not. So it ruined a perfectly good story. And we know what that story is because our culture is imbued with it. Our story is that at one time, depending on which chapter of Genesis you read, we were made on the sixth day in chapter one, but we were made on the first when the earth was still barren in chapter two. That's when God made Adam out of clay, etc., in the Garden of Eden. That's chapter two. Chapter one, it was the sixth day he made man and woman together. So the different stories, still good stories, basically telling us that we were crafted by God Almighty, and that we not only were crafted, but we were in his image. We were a little bit lower than the angels, and we had dominion over the earth. Great story. But what did evolution do to that story? It said we weren't crafted at all. We were a series of mistakes. So it puts us in a different framework, I think. When you stop becoming this perfectly crafted thing over here, so that we came to be this thing that came out of a series of millions of years of mistakes, copy mistakes. So it takes us off a pedestal, I think. It makes us start thinking differently than the other story makes us feel. So the next phase here I'm going to talk about is, it's not about me. And this is a revelation I came to as I was working on this idea of death. I started this long before I knew I was going to speak here because it was a concern to me, and the only way I know how to work things out is to write them out, because I don't know what I'm thinking until I write it down. That's how it seems to work for me. So if it's not about me, what is it about? Well, here's what I'm going to say to reinforce the idea it's not about me. If you ever saw Carl Sagan's story on TV, he has a calendar where he takes the 14.1 billion years that the universe has been here since the Big Bang, and he divides it up into 360 segments and then gives each segment, you know, a day of the year. Then he asks, well, when did things appear in this year? And we find out that Earth doesn't show up until September 14th. And we find out that humans don't come until New Year's Eve, 8 minutes before the ball drops. Okay? So we're latecomers to this whole thing. Did you know that 99.9% of all the species that's ever lived are now extinct? When you think of the great evolutionary tree that you've seen in diagrams, you see, you know, a one-celled animal down at the bottom, and then this thing starts growing up in branches, and every branch is supposed to represent another species. And that somewhere way up at the top, well, first of all, the whole bottom part is almost dead, right? There's a few things that are still green. There's the sponges. There's a bacteria that's been living forever, almost the entire, like 2-point-some million years. There's cuttlefish or lots of things. But nobody you know. And so at the very top, we have this green part that's still green up here. And we have humans, of course, they're in the center in the highest branch because we're so smart. We made the tree, right? And so we end up with us coming late to the party, right? If we're so important, why are we so late to the party? Everybody's here waiting for you to show up, kind of thing. So one logical mark, there is no proof. One logical thing is, if we're so important, why are we showing up so late? So when you think about that tree, I want you to think about the branch that took place 3 million years ago when chimpanzees and hominids branched off about 3 million years ago. And then it keeps going up, and then at the top, that's us. Did you know there's at least 21 different species that were born and now don't exist anymore to get to us? And now the question is, when did we become special? Was it when we branched off the first time? Australopithecus? When we were Homo erectus? When we were Neanderthal? Where did we become special? Well, my guess is there is no place on that tree that we became special. We became cognizant of the fact that we were here and we made ourselves special, but I don't think there is a point where some divine being said, you're special, right? So the next phase I want to talk about, because this is a big topic and I got to break it into little chunks, and I'm not covering anything anywhere near enough, but the afterlife. And I'm entitling this, "I'm sorry, sir, but we don't have your reservation." So what I'm going to do is look at some cultures that had an idea about what the afterlife was about. And I'm going to make a little bit of fun of them. But what I learned earlier today is that I need to have respect for all these. So let's laugh together with respect. So the Egyptians, 6,500 years ago, started to build pyramids as places to put their dead pharaohs on their journey to the afterlife. And in those pyramids, they put a variety of things, different things for different pharaohs, but they all had this journey in mind, and they all had this idea of, we need to equip this person fully for this journey. And so there's chariots, there's walking canes, there's food. They disemboweled the mummy and put them into canopic jars. And so their kidneys were in one and their heart was in another. Unfortunately, they didn't think the brain had any real function. And they had this special little tool that went up through the nose, and they pulled the brain out and threw it away. So now we've got this boat here, and one of the older tombs had a boat that was 132 feet long, that weighed something like 20 tons. And I'm just imagining that the pyramid, I mean the pharaoh, has not left for his journey yet. And how do we know that? And this is my one imitation of Kent. Because it's freaking still there. So I'm just trying to, you know, if it's still there, then he didn't make the journey. So we can kind of chuckle at somebody's idea of, well, when you die, you're going to go on a journey, and we got to give you all this stuff. We can chuckle at that. But eventually I'm going to come to our story, the one our culture tells, and ask, is our story better than that in any qualitative way? And so I'm just thinking about that pharaoh. Maybe he does start his journey, and he wakes up. Where's he going to be? He's going to be in a glass case somewhere in Cairo or London with no place to go. And if you think that flight delays are bad news now, try waiting 6,500 years only to be find out that they threw your brain away. So I want to keep going on with these afterlife stories, because I think that's the real question for any of us. We all know we're going to die, but the question is, what happens then? And I'm just going through some stories about what other people have decided is going to happen then. So I want to mention, go to the Hebrew Bible, and I want to talk about something called Sheol. And that was supposed to be, if I can be quick about this, kind of a murky little place that is kind of fuzzy, and everybody went there. There was no differentiation. I heard a scholar say the other day that that's a misinterpretation of the words, that's not really what they were saying, but I think you'll find a lot of people who were willing to acknowledge that Sheol was there. And what I want to do is read some things that came out of biblical verses that were describing it. And it says, let's see. Here's Job. Before I go to that place of no return, to a land of gloom and utter darkness, to the land of the deepest night, of utter darkness and disorder, where even the light is like darkness. He talks about Sheol in that way. But things don't, and reinforcement, this is something I didn't even know. I think the Old Testament is full of wonderful stories that you don't know about until you actually do a little digging. Here's one out of Samuel that is truly Shakespearean. The scene opens up with Saul disguising himself and traveling to Endor to see a witch. And the witch of Endor says, "I see a ghostly figure coming up out of the earth." And Saul says, this is all of the Bible, these are quotes, "What does he look like?" And the witch of Endor says, "An old man wearing a robe," I don't know if her voice quivered, "is coming up." Then Saul knew it was Samuel, and that's the guy he was looking for, and he bowed down and prostrated himself with his face to the ground, and Samuel says, "Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up?" Right out of the Bible. Kind of an interesting, I didn't know this before. Now, by the time you got to the book of Daniel, which was written towards the end of the period, maybe 165 BCE, it's changed. The story is now progressing from this dark place, etc. And this is what Daniel says, "But at the time, your people, everyone whose name is found written in the book," they must share that with, we're talking about, I'm imagining, St. Peter at the gate, and he's got this book, and you're trying to see if you're going to get through. "Multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to everlasting life, others to shame and everlasting contempt." So you can see how the evolution of what happens after you die evolved right there in the Old Testament. As books got younger, they started being more expansive and bigger in their thoughts about what the afterlife was. It's a lot like the Greeks, who had a place called Hades. You've heard of that, I'm sure. If you've read Homer, you know that Odysseus goes down into Hades. And it's the name of the god who ran it, and was also the name of the place. And it's kind of a lot like Sheol. It's kind of like a dark place, you know. And what we find is that later on in Greek theology, I'll call it, they came with the idea of Elysian. So they started making a place where the nobles and heroes of war went when they went to Hades, a special place just for them. And then as time went on, they expanded to, I guess everybody gets to go. It's kind of like the membership in an exclusive club, and now they're letting the commoners come, that kind of. The Vikings at Valhalla, I think we've seen enough Viking movies on TV to know that you want to die with that sword in your hand, and you want to, and why? Because at the end, you got to go to Valhalla, where you got to drink mead all night and war all day. What a life. Of course, we have a sister religion who thinks that if you blow yourself up, you get 72 virgins. I don't know what the female bombers get. Is it Chippendale? I'm not sure. But it's something like that. But let's go to our story now. Our story is not much more sophisticated, I don't think. I think if you look at these other stories and chuckle and say, oh, geez, that seems kind of corny, or that's not very likely, I think if you go to our story, knowing that we aren't special, that it becomes more and more difficult to rationalize that there's a place called heaven. And especially if you go to a funeral and you have somebody comes up to you and says, you know, Aunt Jane was a wonderful person, but she's looking at us now from heaven and she's wondering why we're so disturbed. But there's another part of the story that says, that's not how it works. That's not how it works. You stay in the ground. And when the last day comes, everybody rises up and there's a big judgment. Two stories telling a completely different stories. So even our own culture has a hard time with what heaven is and where do you go. And also, I just want to point out, and I'm running out of time, I know. I want to point out that even if we had heaven, think about this, that novelists have shown vampires to be full of ennui. They've lived for so long, they're getting so bored, you know, that kind of thing. Well, think about it. How long can you live in the clouds hearing harps before they become old? And do you play bingo on Wednesday, quilt on Thursdays, and deal canasta on Fridays? Do you assemble 10,000-piece jigsaw puzzles all of a blue sky? Do you continue month, every year, every million years, every 10 million years? You get what I'm saying here. What would life be like? It'd be like having a lifetime of eating ice cream for all three meals. Eventually, this doesn't seem so good. So even the potential, I think, of heaven is sort of a misdemeanor. Not misdemeanor. What I mean, misunderstood. It's a misdemeanor, too. All right, and now I'm going to end to show you that I can write poetry. I'm going to end with a poem. And you'll know it's a poem because I'm going to slow down and talk seriously. It doesn't rhyme and there's no meter, see? So you got to look for the cues. All right, so here it is. Death by Richard Comiskey. Celebrate the experience of life, no matter how short it is. We are borrowed from the universe and must be returned. Rejoice we are alive now. Forget about greatness and monuments. They will all crumble with time. Forget about achievement. No one ever acts alone. Forget about returning. Our elements will forever be lost to one another. Forget about your lineage. Our seeds are not precious. Forget about heaven. It's an illusion for those who choose to deny their own eyes. Like the newly hatched mayfly that lives but moments, we must savor what we have. One glorious eruption with no plans for dinner. Everything must die, the sun, the comets, the great sequoias. Know the miracle of dust loving itself, loving others, and to feel the love returned. When it's our time to reunite with the universe, we should sprint ahead with joy, but not yet. Not while there's a moment to savor. Thank you.